Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So here you go. Jeff Bezos saying that Amazon actually supports a corporate tax rate hike. I guess he's got to figure out how to, you know, make himself more likable after the Amazon union busting campaign. And look, we still don't know the numbers. I'm still waiting. Tomorrow, I'm guessing, is when we're going to maybe get some numbers after they've finished bickering over who can vote and who can't. But they're in favor of raising the corporate tax rate up to 28%, even though Joe Manchin is, you know, shooting everyone in the foot by saying, no, can't go above 25. And it's just like a Democrat. I got to be honest, just like a Democrat to say, no, it was 35. They moved it down to 21. We're only going to take it to 25. That's how we got from 56% in 1953 down to 21% right now. Just throwing that out there. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, maybe a hike in the minimum wage, which Jeff Bezos was all in favor of because he pays his warehouse workers $15 an hour, even though that's what they were paying 30 years ago. I've asked our good friend Joe Sandberg to come talk with us. Joe is a progressive business leader and investor. He's also sits on the board of the Center for Health and Democracy. Joe, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So Jeff Bezos is all in favor of the raising of the corporate tax rate. For a guy that doesn't really pay anything, is that kind of amazing?
Well, we need him to be in favor, or more importantly, we just need to implement a global minimum tax on all American corporations, period. And I'm encouraged that Secretary Yellen articulated that priority. In the absence of a global minimum tax on corporations, we can raise the corporate tax rate to whatever you want, but we're going to continue to have giant corporations that pay zero. So that's the crucial step, global minimum tax rate.
I go back and I look at, when Trump moved we moved to kind of a territorial tax, which allowed big corporations to get away from all of this stuff. Can't you just undo that and say, look, if you're doing business here, we're coming for you?
Well, that's part of it. There's still a lot of loopholes that multinational corporations exploit that a global minimum tax is necessary. Look, it's tantamount to what we have for individuals. We have an alternative minimum tax rate, right, for individuals. It's called AMT, and it's intended to prevent individuals from using loopholes to pay below a certain threshold, and we should have the same construct for corporations. And here's the thing, Rick. Most corporations want a global minimum tax because when a small number of multinational corporations pay zero in tax, it's actually anti-business because it puts all the rest of us as business people at a competitive disadvantage. It puts all the rest of the small and medium-sized businesses that employ most Americans at a competitive, unfair disadvantage to giant monopolies that are using their fancy lobbyists and accountants to avoid paying taxes. That's not fair. We want equal, fair competition.
No, and I hope that's right. But I don't see them going, no, we need this. And I don't see us getting to that because too many countries, I think, have an advantage. I've been saying for a long time, we need another Bretton Woods Accord. We need to come back together as a globe and figure out how to tackle the inequality that's happening, not just here in the U.S., but globally. And the tax avoidance is a huge part of that.
Well, there's a major tool in our kit that we don't sufficiently utilize. And that is the power of the Treasury Department to audit the movement of flows of money into and out of dollars. And if we simply said you can't retranslate foreign monies from a multinational company back into U.S. dollars if you're not obeying a global minimum tax, you'd quickly see adherence to a global minimum tax. It's one of our great national assets that, again, we don't fully utilize.
Right.
We have the world's reserve currency, and our status as the world's reserve currency is a credit to everyone, not just a bunch of really rich people at the top, but to the creditworthiness of all of us as Americans. And we ought to use that more to ensure that everyone is playing by the same set of rules.
Which is why there's always the talk that the Chinese want to go to a different currency. And I've heard rumblings that they want their money to be the reserve currency.
Well, that's because they understand that our status is the reserve currency is one of our greatest competitive advantages and one of our greatest protections to national security.
You know, I look at this and it's again, it's one of these moments where it comes down to policy. And I look at how divided we are. And, you know, we can't simply get an infrastructure bill passed through without having these kind of, you know, bizarre fights over what I think is a very small number. Where I look at a country like China, that they're just outperforming us on every front in building their infrastructure and moving towards taking over the future. And we're still mired in this division over, you know, should people be paid a living wage? Should corporations pay no taxes? I mean, it's kind of crazy to me, Joe.
Well, it is. And there's only one remedy, and that's electing new people. I think that we started the process in 20, and we're going to have to continue that process in 22. We're going to need to elect a lot of new governors, and we're going to need to elect new senators. There's no single simple answer. And I think that's been one of our shortcomings over the last couple of decades, is we keep wanting these simple answers that would occur in one election cycle. And by contrast, the right wing organizes itself for a multi-decade, you know, and century-long battle. And the center and center left hasn't met that in match. And until and unless we change that, we're going to continue to get defeated in what matters most, and that's policy outcomes.
Yeah, no, you're right.
The ultra-rich of this country have stripped the country of just about everything it has because they've won the battle at the ballot box over half a century. And the way we're going to put things back together is to win at the ballot box over the next half century.
Yeah, you know, I look at someone like Bezos and coming out for the I think that's a political move more than anything else. I also think, you know, him coming out and saying, hey, oh, we pay all of our workers $15 an hour. You know, I think that's a political move. But, you know, ultimately, you know, I remember 30 years ago, those jobs were paying, you know, 13, 14, 15 bucks an hour 30 years ago. So we've lost, you know, a couple of decades of wage increases. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that unions have been under attack all this time, and that our policy leaders have left us behind. And one of the issues I know you spend a lot of time on is talking about the minimum wage. To me, you know, working at Amazon, $15 an hour is nowhere near worth, you know, working in a place like that, given the constraints, you know, going to the bathroom in bottles, you know, just all of the stuff that goes there. But here we're in this moment where they're touting, hey, we're paying $15 an hour.
Look, the reason that wages have stagnated is simple, and nobody listening needs to have a PhD in economics to understand the why. Wages have stagnated for two reasons. Reason number one, unions have declined in power. And reason number two, companies have become bigger and fewer in number. So there's a simple question of a power balance. On one side, you have workers who have been represented less and less by union. And on the other side, you have companies who are becoming bigger and bigger and fewer. So you have all of these workers who are unrepresented on one side, and you have bigger and bigger behemoth companies on the other side. And the result is what we've lived now for decades, which is stagnant wages. And the remedy is twofold. One, we need to revitalize unionization in this country by going at where it's been attacked, and that's in the court system and in the laws. And two, we need to rebalance fair competition in our markets so that we don't have our private sector dominated by giant monopolies, and we can revitalize small and medium-sized businesses. That's the simple twofold recipe for a return in higher wages.
No, I'm 100% with you, but when I throw that out, I get, well, you know, but China doesn't have to play by those rules, and China's the real competition. They're going to steamroll over that model that you've laid out.
Here's where they're wrong. Our vulnerability to China is in the weakness in our democracy. Because the way we maintain global leadership is through the moral authority of our democratic institutions and the participation of our population in the prosperity of our nation. Whatever headlines you might read about China, they have an inequality that makes the inequality here in the United States look small by comparison. And the way we keep our leadership position in the world is by revitalizing our democratic institutions and restoring a vibrant middle class. The reason we're falling farther behind is because our greatest strengths, which are our democracy and our middle class, are fading. Not because China has some mastery of economics.
So, you know, I'm looking at, there was a story just past my desk yesterday of a bunch of corporate CEOs, you know, McDonald's CEOs and a bunch of other restaurateurs who are saying the $15 an hour minimum wage wouldn't actually hurt them. And in fact, in some places, it's actually, they've done better because, well, duh, people have more money in their pocket. You know, so I look at the fact that the minimum wage is still $7.25 an hour, which is disgraceful. And we have a political system that, you know, doesn't seem interested in moving that. You know, how do we get to a place where work is rewarded? You know, I say this for every president when they come into office. I hope that this is the guy who returns reward to work. That idea that if you work hard, you play by the rules, you get ahead. That we actually believe that. And that we actually, as a policy, move towards that. That idea of a meritocracy is something possible. Even though we know today it's not, how do we get to that point?
Well, let's not look at things as worse than they are, though. We obviously have a long way to go at the federal level, but it's also true that in many states, including states that aren't necessarily blue states like Florida, we've recently passed $15 minimum wages. In Florida, the $15 minimum wage passed with 61% of the vote just this past November. And I think that that's the window into how we can advance this cause. What matters is that as many Americans as possible are living in a place where a living wage is the minimum wage law of the state. And, well, it would be convenient and tidy if we had a president and a Congress in Washington, D.C. that would pass a $15 minimum wage. In the absence of that, then we're just going to have to go state by state by state. And there's some reasons for hope that, look, in states like Florida, that's worked.
Yeah. I want to get your thoughts on the infrastructure plan that the president has unrolled. And now this news that evidently Chuck Schumer has found a way with the Senate parliamentarian to possibly move the infrastructure in a couple of infrastructure bill in a couple of different ways. You know, I think this is vital. I think it has to happen. I'm concerned about breaking it up, though.
I'm concerned about breaking it up, too. And I want to disabuse anyone of this notion that you have to so-called pay for infrastructure. There is a rationale for ensuring that the wealthiest Americans pay their fair share in higher taxes, but don't let anyone confuse you into thinking that that's necessary to quote-unquote pay for infrastructure. Let me share what every business person, from one-person businesses to the biggest companies, all understand, is that you have, on a balance sheet, there's two sides to it. You have your assets and your liabilities, or your debt. And if your assets and your liabilities equal each other, you're not in a debt position. But what we've done as a government federally so dishonestly is we've let people think that if the federal government has debt, then the federal government is a debtor, without looking at all of the tremendous assets that the federal government possesses. Put another way, if you borrow $200,000 to buy a home that costs $225,000, you aren't in a debt position because you have an asset that's worth more than your debt. Similarly, if you borrow $3 trillion to build infrastructure that are fixed capital assets that have long-lived lives that generate tremendous economic productivity in our nation, you're not in a net debt position because you've taken that debt and built an asset with it. So if ever there was something that was totally suited to deficit financing, it's infrastructure, and it's long overdue.
Oh, it's been long overdue for decades, Joe. I mean, this is one of those things that, you know, we were talking about back during the, you know, after 9/11, we're talking about, hey, we need to get the economy moving. Infrastructure, didn't get it done then. You know, the collapse happens in 2008 and 2009. Hey, show me those shovel-ready projects. We didn't get enough done then. We've been talking about this for decades.
I know. And, of course, the economy's been growing at a sluggish rate. It's no different than if you have a car and you haven't put oil in the car for, you know, imagine if you don't give your car an oil change for 3 years. It's not going to work very well. Well, it's the same thing with an economy. If you don't upgrade the infrastructure, you know, periodically, the economy isn't going to function as smoothly. And that's what we're experiencing now. Everyone who travels the country understands our infrastructure is an embarrassment on the world stage. And it doesn't have to be that way. And I actually am cautiously optimistic that we're going to get some good results on infrastructure, you know, from this administration. Let's see.
No, I am too. I'm guardedly optimistic in thinking that we have the ability to turn a corner and to transform our country and our economy in ways that are going to be felt, you know, 30, 40, 50 years from now, that our grandkids are going to look back and go, hey, this was, thanks. You didn't screw us too badly.
Yeah. What I'm waiting to see is where we're going to get the $15 minimum wage. If we don't pass a $15 minimum wage, I think there is going to be hell to pay at the ballot box in 22.
Yeah, sadly, I just don't see that happening. I just don't see the, you know, with the Joe Manchins of the world. Just like I'm as much as I want the PRO Act, I just don't see, you know, the handful of people who are on the Democratic side signing on to it. I don't see Angus King jumping on board. I don't see Warner from Virginia. I don't see Kelly and Simina. I don't see them jumping on.
Well, they're going to have primary challenges in that case. I don't know what to say. I mean, that's the only solution, right? Because we have to primary them when they're up.
No, and this is where, you know, again, you look at the positions that we're in. It's because of how divided our political system is, and how we're just pitted against one another. I mean, it's scary times for me.
Yeah, it is. But here's the good news, I think, and this isn't just a pithy line. The future is uncertain, and that's the reason we can be optimistic. If the future were baked in the cake bad, that's the reason to be despaired. But the future is ours to write. And if we make the right choices and we organize, there's no reason that we can't turn these things around.
Yep, that's the bit of optimism. I think if we get this infrastructure bill put through, we get people back to work. I think the snowball of optimism and of good things happens. And things will be okay. But Joe, I appreciate the time and the thoughts. It's always great having a conversation with you.
Well, likewise, and thanks for your voice. It's really important, Rick.
Good stuff, Joe Sandberg. No, look, I don't want to paint that dark doom and gloom picture of I fear nothing's going to get done. Mitch McConnell has basically said it's not happening. So anything that McConnell can do to stop the infrastructure bill from happening, from us getting better roads and bridges and broadband. Look, today I tweeted out, my phone says 5G. I just got a brand new cell phone, and it says 5G. And I'm going, it's just as crummy as the 4G was. And in fact, it was, you know, worse than that. And then I got to another spot, and it said 4G, and it was even slower yet. And then I got to a place where it said 3G, and it was actually faster than the 5G. So you figure it out, because I can't. I was waiting to maybe I got down to no G and it would be okay. But you know, this is life in rural America with broadband access, which is why we need the investment. I'll take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.